the beautiful campus of Texas A&M University, the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology brings you the Sports Medicine Podcast. Our mission is to make sense of and connect the science, practice, and application of the latest findings in sports medicine and human performance to the real world. Here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Hello, and I want to welcome everyone to the weekly podcast from the Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance. Every week we try to bring you the leaders in sports science from around the country and actually internationally. And today is no exception. We are quite pleased to have Dr. David Wright with us in the studio. He's a professor at Texas A&M, where he's actually the unit head of the kinesiology division. He has his PhD from Penn State, and his research is focused on, to quote, "practice context mediates efficient planning of movement timing." Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Wright. Thank you for being here.
I appreciate the invite.
Can you tell us what that means?
Well, I've been listening to the podcast over the last few weeks, and I noticed that you've mentioned the practice issue a number of times, and primarily focused on the notion that the more practice that you have, the more likely you are to different ways that you can structure or manipulate practice to expedite the learning process. So that's essentially what that long description described.
Quality of practice.
Right. So we can look at different forms of practice. Most people, when they think of practice, are thinking physical practice, that you actually run around, jump, hop, all those sorts of things that you would do to improve performance. We look at not only physical practice in terms of how you organize the presentation of trials or practice episodes. So you might think in terms of how you space practice in time, how you organize different drills in a practice. Mm. But we also think about other types of practice, like observational learning through observation. So it's a different form of practice where you don't actually physically engage the task. But presumably you learn something from observing from people, and we try to understand how that process works.
So since we're in the middle of football season right now, so when you're talking about observational, you're talking about like maybe film sessions where the football players sit down and watch film of their upcoming opponents, and that's considered a form of practice.
Sure. I mean, you know, you could watch film, you could watch real live performance. You can try to create the observation for yourself. This is typically called imagery. It's not the same as observation, but is a form of that type of practice.
Well, when you talk about the imagery, that's fascinating, because I often see like Olympic athletes, especially seems like alpine sports, bobsledders and so forth, and you see them with their eyes closed at the start, and they're swaying and swinging back and forth. They're visualizing the course. Is that kind of what you're talking about?
So in a lot of those cases, we would address the imagery perspective from learning. Mm. So what can you do with respect to replacing physical practice with this kind of covert mental rehearsal? So that would be one reason for using imagery. Mm-hmm. Another reason would be maybe more likely what's going on in that situation where those individuals are going through a series of mental preparation. Mm. So they're trying to remove distractors. They're trying to quiet the system. They're trying to ready themselves to perform well. In that case, you're trying to optimize performance. This alternative way that we would really address is this notion that you're trying to improve the learning process, speed up the acquisition of the actual skill, as opposed to just merely meet your optimum at that point in time. So there's some different ways you could look at the imagery process, but both of those are important, I think.
So is there an optimal way to do this imagery kind of things to help you practice? If people are listening and going, you know, that sounds really cool, I can actually practice without actually putting in the sweat.
Well, I think right now there is a whole debate as to, you know, what you actually get from imaging. Mm-hmm. Most people agree that when you learn movements or you're acquiring some memory for this skill, and mm-hmm. this memory is housed in a cognitive system. We talk about the idea that these are represented in memory in some way, presumably in some fashion in the brain. The idea that you can mentally engage in the activity should somehow improve that particular component of the skill behavior. I think most people would argue that it would be unlikely you'd be really skilled without engaging in the physical part. Mm-hmm. So some sort of mixing of covert imagery type rehearsal and also lots and lots of physical enactment of the skill would probably, you know, the ultimate way to try and improve performance.
Now, okay, I'm going to ask you a loaded question. So you said it's really not known if this is helpful. What's your best guess? How much does it add to performance if someone does it?
That's not fair. Oh. I think this is me asking you, what's the contribution of genetics to performance relative to practice or engagement?
50%. I'll give you an answer, 50%.
Yeah, I'm going to go with that one too then.
Okay.
So I think likely probably less. Yeah. But certainly there's a contribution.
But I guess what I'm asking is it a big factor, a small factor? Elite athletes, will they gain from doing something like that? Well, the recreational athlete,
I think both can gain from doing this, but certainly, again, I think the elite athlete likely is using imagery for that other perspective that I mentioned, where they would engage in this quite frequently, but it's really to try to maximize their current state so that they can perform as well as they have trained to perform. With respect to learning, I think probably smaller than 50%, but certainly a contribution there from this kind of covert, non-physical type of practice.
Yeah. And I think what falls into this, you've done research with motor programming with speech.
Yeah.
So can you tell us more about that and how speech plays into this, some of this motor programming?
Yeah, well, this was interesting. I'm not a speech expert by any means, but actually worked on a collaboration with a gentleman at the Health Science Center in San Antonio who is a speech pathologist. And it's kind of interesting. We kind of got hooked up together in a very odd way, and I won't go into describing that. But essentially, we were looking at this notion of motor programming, which is, well, let me use speech as kind of a way to illustrate this. So you can imagine in speech, you have a number of different parts to actually speaking. One is you have to access the lexicon. We might think of this as kind of the language component. Mm-hmm. Then you have to take that language component and somehow convert it into motor output, which is the speech part, the motor control part. Mm-hmm. The interface between those two in that whole activity would be referred to as motor programming, where you convert this abstract information in the lexicon to output that obviously we all have to deal with. So we'd been looking at this kind of interface process, motor programming, with reaching motions. And it turns out that this disorder called apraxia of speech, at least the speech pathologist felt it was at this kind of interface he wanted to start looking at with respect to this disorder. So with my work in the reaching work on motor programming and his interest in speech, we took the two together here and we started applying some of the paradigms we use to investigate this process with respect to this disorder. The disorder is kind of interesting. It's one where individuals have complete access to the vocabulary. So if you point at an object and ask them what it is, they know it's a chair.
Yeah.
They have very good control of the speech apparatus. If you put a force transducer, for example, on the lips or the tongue, and you ask them to follow a sine wave or some information on a computer screen by moving their tongue or their lips, some part of the speech apparatus, they can do this fine. Mm. It's putting the two together is where the problem lies. Mm. At least some people believe it's in this kind of motor programming type of process where the disorder lies. And so we've looked at some of those things. And really the goal was eventually to look at some of our practice procedures of whether or not we could use those to target that particular process and its dysfunction.
Can you?
Well, I know of one study which my collaborators engaged in and where he's had some success. And one of the issues related to practice that we look at is this a kind of presentation order type of manipulation, which is kind of generally referred to as contextual interference. Mm. The idea here is that if you are learning multiple tasks, multiple activities, that a presentation of those activities in some sort of variable order rather than repetitive practice turns out to be quite useful, in particular for dealing with novel situations.
So you break down a task into different sections and you teach people these sections in different order.
In the case of speech, you might pick pronunciation of syllables. Mm. And if there's a particular problem with certain pronunciations of certain syllables, you might mix those together in a practice format rather than repeat the same syllable over and over again, which is actually a very common form of training for these disorders. Mm. It turns out that when you do this, not only do you acquire the actual syllables that are being articulated, but you actually speed up the acquisition of other related syllables. Mm. So again, the idea is that we've shown in other arenas that this kind of varied practice is quite useful for learning features of reaching skills, keyboarding type skills, which are the sort of skills that we typically look at. It turns out this applies very nicely to quite different motor apparatus here.
Yeah. Now, when you're talking about reaching skills,
reaching and grasping, so we look at the coordination of reaching and grasping. So, for example, in disorders like Parkinson's, where they'll move very slowly and there'll be very jerky types of motions, this is a kind of nice model to look at some of those behaviors. In our lab, we typically use keyboarding activities, and it's nice because those very definitive responses you want. There's a certain order of keys you want punched. There's a certain amount of force you want produced. There's a certain timing in producing those. So it's a very nice model to look at, you know, skill behavior.
Yeah. Do all these findings also apply to aging? I mean, you've been talking about kind of models where there's a disorder present. There's an interference to that interface. Does this work with aging when some of these things start to degrade over time?
I haven't done much in the aging domain, but certainly there are features in there where the processes slow down or they executed with more error. I think Charlie Shea is coming in shortly. I think he's on the list for the podcast, and I think probably Charlie has probably some idea on. I know he's done some aging work.
Yeah, he's aging.
Yes, we all are.
This is interesting work. How do you measure this stuff? How do you monitor it?
Well, lots of different ways. We can look at behavior. So we can look at how fast and accurate people produce responses, if that's one of the goals. We can measure features of how muscle groups are being used. So we can use EMG responses.
And that's where you just put electrodes on and you
on
monitor
muscles,
the activation.
And you look at, you know, amplitude of activation, coordination, when muscles are on, off, how long they're on and off. You can look at, certainly my collaborator is pretty involved. The gentleman I mentioned with the speech is now moving where they're looking at neural activation patterns. So a lot of these behaviors are done in a magnet scanner using fMRI, and they will look at essentially in real time, you know, what regions of the brain are active as the activity is being produced. And so he's interested in trying to identify some of the neural underpinnings of these disorders, speech apraxia being one of these, but he's also interested in stuttering. Now we've done a very small subset of work on speech, and we've done some more of the keyboarding activities, which are, again, we use as a kind of model of normal behavior. We have some interesting stuff going on now that's a little deviation from this, which is actually looking at exercise.
That's good. We're a sports medicine podcast, so we're good that we're talking about exercise here.
Yeah, it's kind of sad in the sense that we've spent all this time looking at practice and how we can manipulate practice. And essentially, you know, what we're interested in is kind of underlying all this is the memory for these skill behaviors and how the factors that obviously impinge on that. And we've never, ever considered exercise as kind of an intervention for improving this. And it seems currently there's a very big interest in memory performance, cognitive performance, and exercise. Mm-hmm. And we've kind of snuck again into this in sort of the back door because we were first started looking at the role of sleep and the idea that memory can be enhanced if you get exposed to sleep after this. And
we have all our producers looking at each other.
And they're thinking, this is great, because they like this in class too, when I say, you know, you should sleep to remember, and every undergraduate student is cheering at that point.
There you go, absolutely.
But it turns out in the way the sleep process works to help memory is that during the deep sleep stages, that there's chemical processes where you upregulate certain growth factors that help consolidate or kind of stabilize formalize memories. And it turns out when you exercise, some of those same growth factors are upregulated. So we've started to investigate acute bouts of exercise and their impact on memory for these skill behaviors. We study these keyboarding activities that I've mentioned a number of times.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting you bring up sleep, because one of the continuing problems we hear about when we interview coaches on this show is that their athletes don't get enough sleep, especially college-age athletes, because they're involved in so many different things. And it's just they choose to cut out the sleep, which doesn't help them recover and doesn't help with all the memory issues and so forth as well.
Well, I mean, you know, you don't just have to look at the athletes. I mean, you can probably ask the students here. When you get tight for time, the two things that you start to cut back on, sleep and exercise. And I think it's pretty well documented now that for declarative memory, which is not the sort of memory I would study, which is more verbal learning, memory for facts, but even for procedural memory, which is, again, more what I'm interested in, memory for skilled behaviors, these two factors turn out to be really, really critical. There's some very nice work out of Harvard and Berkeley showing massive effects both on the front end. If you are deprived of sleep, you encode information very poorly, very slowly, very error-filled. And if you, on the back end, if you presented information, you learn some information, you don't get adequate sleep in between the next time you're required to recall this, you show very poor stable memories, and the fact people have very poor recall. So whether you think in terms of helping you learn stuff in the first place or actually helping you kind of maintain that information in memory, if you start to take away from your natural sleep processes here, it's very detrimental. Uh-huh. And this seems to be true with exercise too. We're only starting to delve into this, but it seems to be that there are similar sorts of effects with if you don't exercise on the memory sense of things.
Well, and I would dare say that happens with humans in general. They get tight for time. The two things they cut back on are sleep and exercise.
Yeah.
The two things they probably shouldn't cut back on.
And we know this. I know this. I do it, and I think probably everyone sitting here does the same thing. It's very convenient, and easy to do, but pretty detrimental for your performance.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff. So you said that you guys are starting to do some exercise studies.
Yes.
So do you think all this is going to apply to exercise the same way it has with sleep and reaching and keyboarding? And
so the evidence is pretty clear that if you are a chronic exerciser, you seem to get some benefits. Mm-hmm. And again, we have obvious benefits, cardiovascular benefits, you know, bone integrity benefits, I mean, stuff that probably many of the podcasts have covered. Here we're looking at cognitive function.
Right.
So, for example, those who are chronic exercisers tend to be less likely to suffer from Alzheimer's. Mm. Again, aging deficits, if you exercise, again, from memory function, cognitive function seem to be less if you're a chronic exerciser.
Let's repeat that for our listeners. If you exercise, you have lower rate of Alzheimer's.
Yes, and also generally better cognitive function as you age.
And there's no other treatment at this point that does that?
Not that I'm aware of.
Exercise if you want to keep your brain. Okay, I'm sorry. Back to our regular programming now.
That's a good thing. what we're interested in is not so much the idea that you can have chronic exercises and these improvements. More looking at this idea of acute bouts of exercise. Mm. Can mm-hmm. you use exercise as a means to give you kind of a immediate boost?
Mm.
And you can think of lots of situations like this. If you're traveling and you have a big meeting coming up and you want to make sure that you retain all this important information you need to present, you know, maybe one of the things we might need to provide here is an opportunity to exercise before this, and you get. But there's a variety of ways you could think of this working, and we have a series of experiments set up right now. In fact, with Steve Reichman, where he's the exercise guru, and one of the things we have to resolve here is the actual nature of the exercise. There is very few studies that have been conducted like this, and the few that are done, the exercise regimes are all quite different. If you exercise too vigorously, you have cortisol produced, and then that maybe negate the benefits of the other growth factors are produced. So there's a whole variety of things that go into this, but we're hoping that what we can find here is that the exercise provides some protection for memories that are generated from some bout of practice or learning previous to that. And in the sleep world, this has been shown with naps.
Mm.
My wife was a big power napper, and in college, it turns out she was much smarter than me, because I always argued this was not a good thing. And it turns out that naps are very important. And when you look at the expertise literature, the people who are experts have found out, maybe intuitively, that it's good to nap during the day to maximize their practice during the day. So again, you have a lot of anecdotal evidence kind of supporting that notion too.
President Johnson always took naps in the afternoon.
Yes. Okay.
Well, you know, this being Texas and, you know, LBJ being one of our native
sons.
That's
right, yeah.
Yeah, so,
you know. And, you know, we have other presidents and maybe some in the future, who knows.
Maybe they need to take naps is what you're saying.
This is a good thing. I think this is my plan right after this is over.
Exercise and nap.
Yeah.
Maybe not in that order.
These are, you know, again, we kind of joke about this, but these are really, really important things that people should be considering. And again, we kind of frown on people sometimes that, you know, take a break during the day. But if the literature is on track here, it certainly supports that there is some benefit to that.
Where do you see your research going? If I came back to you, if we come back in 5 years and we say, Dave, what have you done differently between 2011 and 2016.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm hoping that I'm kind of excited about the exercise work, frankly. I mean, I'm hoping that this will. I mean, we're not moving too far. We're still looking at procedural memory.
Sure.
But we're not moving away from practice in a sense. I mean, I see exercise as kind of an alternative form of practice in some sense. So really, this is an extension of what I've been doing for 20 years. But, you know, at some points in your career, it's kind of fun to venture and deal with some new issues. Here we're having to learn some new techniques about in terms of the data we deal with. You know, we'll have blood draws, and we'll have to look at how to, you know, assess these different growth factors. There are a whole variety of growth factors we could look at. So this is all new for me. And so I'm excited about kind of learning something about that process. And hopefully, and again, if we can find another reason to argue for exercise being important, I think anyone who's in kinesiology, this would be a good thing.
If we have a student that's very interested in this and wants to study with the infamous Dave Wright, it's really kind of the area of motor neuroscience.
Yes.
If they're kind of looking for a general term under which to look.
Yeah, in the older terms, motor behavior, nowadays motor neuroscience, essentially the neuroscience area has exploded in the last 15, 20 years. And while there are many, many different facets of neuroscience, typically we fall into systems neuroscience. Even within that, cognitive neuroscience or motor neuroscience would be the two arenas that you would probably find people like myself.
Fascinating. So we're running a little bit short on time. So what's your take-home message?
This is easy, right?
Yeah.
Exercise and sleep. The second half is probably easier.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, we know, again, as I've mentioned earlier, we have massive benefits that are well described, cardiovascular benefits, benefits for the skeletal system, and here we're seeing really important benefits for the nervous system and for kind of the functional features of that, you know, cognitive performance. I hope that people will take that message and run with it.
Super. Thanks, Dave, for being with us today.
Appreciate it.
And thanks for everyone that has been listening out there that took the time to download us, and we really appreciate your time that you've spent with us today. We have our question of the podcast, Justin.
So how does the process of sleep help memory?
So be the first one to email us the correct response to that question, and you'll win one of our nifty Huffines Institute podcast t-shirts. Be the first in your neighborhood to do so. Dave has a t-shirt, doesn't he? No, I guess he will though shortly.
So. Thank you.
So again, we hope that you all join us next week. And until then, we hope you have an active and healthy week.
The Sports Medicine Podcast is produced by Justin Dobson and licensed by the Huffines Institute at Texas A&M under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. You can share it as much as you want, and you can talk or blog about it all you want. Just don't change it or charge money for it. This podcast is made possible by support from the Omar Smith family and the Sidney and J.L. Huffines family. Our music was composed, performed, and graciously provided by Dave Zeltner Productions, your source for quality music and music production since 1992. Find them at www.davidzeltner.com. Our opening and closing credits were provided by John Miles Productions at johnmilesproductions.com. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.